This is an impact that we're going to see over the next decade that could potentially disrupt all the major fisheries in Alaska.
A troubling trend in Alaska's oceans. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, the 13th of August. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, defending the Point Hope hunters accused of wanton waste of caribou.
They do not believe that the way this has worked with the state, that their process has represented them fairly.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Northern Air Cargo, with scheduled flights to 16 destinations throughout Alaska every week. Northern Air Cargo, building strong relationships with the communities they serve.
Alaska's oceans are acidifying at a troubling rate. Water samples collected this spring from the Bering Sea and the Gulf of Alaska show the problem is happening more quickly and is more severe than in warmer parts of the planet. And that could have big implications for Alaska's fisheries in the years ahead. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
When carbon dioxide is released into the air, it warms the earth, but much of it is sucked up into the ocean, where it lowers the water's pH level, increasing acidity.
I think this is very worrisome for Alaska.
Jeremy Mathis is an oceanographer at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. He spent the last few years testing the pH levels in the Chukchi and Bering Seas and in the northern Gulf of Alaska. And the level of acidification he's finding is worse than he expected.
It does seem to be more accelerated in Alaska because of the colder water temperatures. Colder water can naturally hold more carbon dioxide, and the carbon dioxide is what's ultimately controlling the pH in the water.
Along with their cold temperatures, Alaska's oceans also absorb more carbon dioxide because they're so productive. In the spring, the oceans produce intense phytoplankton blooms that feed on carbon. Mathis says that creates a lot of organic matter in a very short amount of time.
And as that organic matter sinks down from the surface, it sort of rots like what terrestrial matter would rot, what we think of like organic matter rotting on land. This organic matter that's produced during these phytoplankton blooms ultimately turns back into carbon dioxide once it gets down sort of away from the surface.
That combination of accumulating carbon on the ocean floor from the plankton with an increase in human emissions of carbon dioxide into the air is what's causing the pH level to drop. And that's problematic for any organism that forms a shell, like crabs, clams, or much smaller creatures.
And these organisms have adapted their physiology to sort of exist at a pH level. And so as the pH drops in their environment, they have to expend energy to internally regulate their pH. They have to respond to this pH change that they're seeing. And if they're spending energy regulating their pH, then that's energy that they're not spending on growth and foraging and reproduction and their normal biological cycle.
Mathis says a favorite food of salmon, the pteropod, is going to be hit especially hard.
Due to the composition of their shells, they're probably going to be the first organism or one of the first organisms that are really going to have a negative impact or be negatively impacted from this additional acidification that's going on.
The pH levels are already low enough in Alaska waters to be corrosive to shell-building organisms, but Mathis says whether those effects have made it up the food chain to fish is harder to say.
But I think the potential is definitely there for this to be an impact issue today. This isn't the case of where we're going to talk about this as 100 years from now, an impact 100 years from now. I think this is an impact that we're going to see over the next decade that could potentially disrupt all the major fisheries in Alaska.
Acidification could lead to a decline in the body weight of fish or in their population numbers. Mathis is planning a new study on pollock to get a better handle on how fish will respond. He'll hatch and raise them in a lab under the type of acidic conditions expected in the oceans in the decades ahead. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
The eight Point Hope defendants charged with wasting caribou will have a pretrial hearing on August 20th. State wildlife troopers say more than 100 caribou were shot last summer, and the troopers contend that nearly 40 of those caribou were all or partially wasted. The North Slope Borough has decided to provide $56,000 to Point Hope to aid the eight hunters with hiring attorneys to defend them. Harold Curran is the chief administrative officer for the borough and is acting mayor when North Slope Borough Mayor Edward Itta is away. Curran says the eight village men charged believed they were protecting their community from disease. He says traditional foods are eaten raw, dried, and fermented, and shared with the entire community.
And are butchered without the use of personal protective gear and are often butchered in common areas. In that kind of setting, it is not unusual to have to protect against infectious agents that are present on the North Slope, which can cause sickness and possibly death to people in the community.
State laws require harvesting animals regardless of whether the meat looks suspicious. Leaving meat is, in legal terms, a wanton waste crime. But Curran says the federal government protects urban Americans by taking extreme food protection measures, such as killing all the cattle in a feedlot if only one has mad cow disease, or pulling all leaf spinach from produce sections if salmonella or other bacteria is discovered in part of a crop.
What the state is doing is saying, we want to criminalize that system of protection amongst Point Hope hunters. And it says to the hunters and the people of Point Hope, you need to bear that risk, whereas the people in urban America do not and should not. That is unfair and completely inappropriate.
He says the state needs to develop different regulations for subsistence takes that addresses diseased animals and the definition of wanton waste. He says the traditional doctrines of respecting and not wasting the resource go back generations, and Point Hope Village leaders sent a letter to the governor asking for evidence of people who may have acted inappropriately.
They did not believe that the way this has worked with the state, that their process has represented them fairly, has characterized the community fairly. And unfortunately, what that does do among some people is undermine trust.
Curran says the troopers characterizing village elders as uncooperative was unfair. Jim Dow is the lead biologist for the Western Arctic caribou herd for the state's Department of Fish and Game. Dow has worked out of Kotzebue monitoring the herd for more than 20 years. He says the most recent assessment was in 2007 when 10 animals were shot near Ambler specifically for health assessments. He says they looked at contaminant load, parasites, and incidence of antibodies in the blood that would indicate exposure to disease.
Now, the vet that did that works for Fish and Game, Dr. Kimberly Beckman. And her comment was she's done health assessments on 9 herds, I think, in the state now. And of the caribou that she had looked at, that, you know, gross characteristics, she thought these Western Arctic caribou were some of the healthiest that she had seen.
Dow says there have been 2 large die-off events in the Western Arctic herd since the mid-90s. Both events were caused by starvation. He says tapeworms and hoof rot has ebbed and flowed in intensity in the herd, but for the most part, hunters report that the animals are in good shape. Dow was surprised when he heard of the charges of waste. He says it runs counter to all his years of experience working with hunters.
No culture and no group of hunters has the market cornered on either good or bad behavior. But, you know, I think most hunters, you know, they don't want to leave meat in the field. That's just counter to why they're out there. Especially village guys. I mean, they're not out there for anything really but meat. You know, the heads are always left out there. And, you know, why else would they shoot them?
Dow says the Western Arctic caribou herd numbers around 377,000 animals, down from a peak of 490,000 6 years ago. He says unusually severe icing conditions in recent winters that make foraging difficult may be contributing to the drop in numbers. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Hooper Bay residents make their case to Obama's cabinet.
And the audit shows these huge costs in transportation, and you saw the vast distance coming out here.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP. teaming up with Alaskans since statehood and together looking toward a bright future.
Four U.S. secretaries made a two-hour visit to the coastal village of Hooper Bay after their short stop in Bethel. The trip was an opportunity for local leaders to show firsthand the challenges they face in remote Alaska. KYUK's Shane Iverson has more.
The weather in Hooper Bay was typical, but the visit was not. At the airstrip, a motorcade of pickup trucks were awaiting the entourage. The secretaries, local leaders, and press piled in. A flashing police SUV led the way. Staff aides rode in truck beds as a light rain fell. Four-wheelers snuck in along the side of the roads. The first stop was to the newly constructed school. There, the secretaries met with the public.
Hi, how are you? Sean Donovan, nice to meet you.
Colin McCourt, a city council member. Welcome to Hooper Bay.
Well, thank you.
After a brief public meeting, the secretaries began their tour. First, they walked the halls of the school, led by Lower Yukon Superintendent John Lamont. Lamont emphasized the increased significance of village schools to Education Secretary Arnie Duncan.
At all our schools, the library and the resource room are probably the two most important parts of the school beside the gymnasium. And so this is the community school. It's not just the school, it belongs to everyone. And most of the community activities happen in the schools.
Is this the community library as well?
This is the only library in the whole village.
This is the only one.
Right.
Then the secretaries walked the streets to look at a housing project. The Association of Village Council Presidents Housing Authority is building a 19-family townhouse complex. AVCP Housing Director Ron Hoffman walked alongside Housing Secretary Sean Donovan. Hoffman described the construction challenges unique to remote Alaska.
Our window of opportunity is short. May to September. We have that opportunity to close the houses in, or else we will be going to winter and we will be experiencing, you know, come December, November, extreme weather conditions.
Hoffman, along with Calista President and CEO Matthew Nicolai, gathered with all four secretaries in front of the complex. Nicolai took the chance to explain a cost that he says always troubles funding agencies in the nation's capital.
In the audit, it shows these huge costs in transportation, and there's always a, in the audit shows that, you know, why is this so high? And you saw the vast distance coming out here. That burns us.
Then it was back to the motorcade to travel to the other end of the village. There, spinning above the skyline, stand three wind turbines. They were constructed by AVEC, the Alaska Village Electric Cooperative. President Mira Kohler said much of the funding came through the Agriculture Department, which Secretary Tom Vilsack now runs.
So these are three 100-kilowatt turbines, and these were funded primarily by USDA Rural Development and by the Valley Commission. So it's something that...
So, Vilsack,
you know,
this is your money working.
It is.
Kohler says the turbines will displace about 20% of Hooper Bay's heating fuel needs once they're tied into the power grid. Just two other wind systems are currently set up in the YK Delta, one in Tuksuk Bay and the other in Kosigluk. Nicolai said with some help from the federal government, many more would be possible.
We have 28 villages that actually can get this, but we're in line. It takes more than 3 years to get on line for these props. I always call them props. Wind generator. It is a.
Don't put it on your plane.
I know.
Okay. Don't do that.
So there's a procedure that we'd like to see in Congress change.
Alaska Senator Mark Begich says the trip is more than just good publicity. He says their visit will assist Alaskans during the secretary's tenure.
They're becoming aware every minute on the ground here. What I like to describe as extreme rural is really about, because rural America is nothing like this. And so they're learning very quickly. And for us, that's going to be a huge advantage. When we sit down and say, okay, here's what we need to do, here's how we need to do it, they understand. I mean,
the secretaries will continue their rural tour of America. Their next stop is Wednesday, August 19th at the Pending Groth Center Cattle Barn at the Iowa State Fair. I'm Shane Iverson.
The rural arm of the University of Alaska Fairbanks is getting a boost from federal grant money. $2 million from the U.S. Department of Education will pay for renovation and expansion of the Interior Aleutians campus facility in Fairbanks. Center Director Clara Johnson says a new hub and spoke layout is aimed at improving student-teacher interaction.
offices on the outside, and in the center of that will be the where the student activities happen, where the classroom, the lab space, to have that kind of nested in the midst of the faculty offices, and the faculty offices open into that room.
Johnson says the new learning space is specifically designed to improve science, technology, engineering, and math education for rural UAF students who come to Fairbanks for periods of intensive study. The plan is to have the addition and renovation work completed by next fall. Johnson says another $340,000 Education Department grant will fund additional programs.
A development grant where we're going to be working on our tribal management and construction trades and student support services.
The UAF Interior Aleutians campus serves more than 500 students in 60 villages. Southeast lawmakers will try again next year to fund four tourism projects vetoed by former Governor Sarah Palin. That's because they failed to override those vetoes during Monday's special legislative session. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
The Anchorage meeting was called to confirm new Lieutenant Governor Craig Campbell and to override Palin's veto of about $28 million in federal stimulus funds for energy projects. Those two measures passed. But some lawmakers also tried to override the former governor's vetoes of half a dozen projects from the capital budget, four of which were in Southeast. They won support from 40 of the 59 lawmakers attending the special session, but that was five short of the number needed to resurrect the projects. Palin vetoed $2.3 million toward cruise ship berth replacement and improvements in Ketchikan. She also cut $2.6 million for sidewalk and park work in Sitka. Sitka Senator Bert Stedman put money for the projects in the capital budget approved by the legislature last spring. He says he'll do the same thing next year.
They're all good projects that'll help the visitors industry in Ketchikan and Sitka. But it would have been nice to have the appropriation authorization so we could put those projects on the street as soon as possible and preferably have crews working on them this winter and into next summer. But we'll have a several month delay now.
The projects were to be funded by revenues from the head tax charged to cruise ship passengers. That tax funds projects and services used by tourists, as well as an environmental monitoring program. The veto override attempt also included about $5 million in court system improvements, most in Anchorage, but some statewide. The total to be reinstated was $10 million. Stedman says he's not surprised the effort failed.
You know, when you look at veto overrides on capital budgets, there's been very few that have succeeded in the life of the state of Alaska. So it's a difficult number to obtain, a three-quarter vote, as you can see with the weatherization money and how what a high profile that had around the state. And that was, you know, passed by one vote.
The four tourism project vetoes were in Stedman's Senate district, which includes Sitka, Ketchikan, Petersburg, and Wrangell. 50 other projects totaling about $55 million were left intact. At the time of the vetoes, Palin's budget office pointed out that that included about $16 million for other work in Stedman's district. Palin has targeted the district and head tax projects before. Stedman says that's not unusual, since his job as Senate Finance Committee co-chairman is to assemble the capital budget, and that puts him in an adversarial role.
Clearly, there was some concerns over the last few years' capital budget with the previous governor, with omissions around the state of projects and or concentrations, heavy concentrations in a couple of areas and leaving vast areas of the state with nothing. So, you know, we had to work to rectify that and get a balance of appropriations around the state. And naturally, that led to some difficult discussions with the administration and the governor.
Stedman says he expects a better relationship with Sean Parnell, who became governor when Palin resigned. Parnell is a former Senate Finance Committee member, and Stedman says they're already talking about how to handle head tax-funded projects in next year's budget. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting from Juneau.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Earlier this week, Mountain View hosted a house party of sorts. The purpose was to celebrate the continuing renovation of one of Anchorage's oldest neighborhoods. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
Immediately before the jaws of a large steam shovel began chewing up the long, low-slung motel-like rental units on North Bliss Street, a quartet of speakers praised federal funding, private-public partnerships, and most of all, the changes taking place in Anchorage's Mountain View. The president of Cook Inlet Housing Authority, Carol Gore, began by describing Tuesday's demolition target.
This property will be part of a scattered site redevelopment, much like our previous developments here. We've come to describe the building behind us as a barracks. I think that's a kind description for the property. The redevelopment also includes the adjacent basement that was fire some many, many years ago, and the duplex next door. So it's really five properties.
The new unit will consist of 10 rent-to-own townhouses. There'll be 2 2-bedroom, 6 3-bedroom, and 2 4-bedroom homes. The project represents 11 construction jobs, 5 permanent jobs, and a $3 million investment. Since 2002, when Cook Inlet Housing Authority first turned its attention to developing lower-cost housing in Mountain View, it has purchased and redeveloped 115 blighted properties, invested $60 million in the neighborhood, and provided nearly 170 affordable homes. Some of the funding for Mountain View's renaissance came from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, and Secretary Sean Donovan happily provided examples.
I'm proud of the work that HUD is doing to contribute to this revitalization. From community development block grant funding that helped make possible the library, a recreation center, and the Alaska Museum of Natural History, to the recent allocation of neighborhood stabilization funds that have allowed Mountain View to develop 16 units of affordable housing for low-income families.
Donovan is visiting Alaska as part of President Obama's rural tour, taking cabinet secretaries and federal officials to rural communities across the country. Donovan is one of 4 cabinet members currently in Alaska. In his comments, Anchorage Mayor Dan Sullivan noted other changes taking place in Mountain View.
If you look at the police department reports, there's a 19% reduction in incidents in Mountain View overall, and that's a direct result of the improvements that are being made. Prior to 2006, Mountain View averaged 20 structural fires a year. Now it's down to 0.
In a question period, Gore was asked if Mountain View might undergo so much gentrification that low-income people would be driven out of their neighborhood.
I think sometimes gentrification gets just a bad rap. For us, we look at the percentage of our investment here to preserve affordable housing as we attract others of higher income. So today our investment is about 10%. We're looking at no more than 15%. We continue to own the land so that we can preserve affordability for the families that are invested here that we've brought in.
Secretary Donovan said retaining the land in trust as the homeowner builds equity is in keeping with federal support goals.
Protecting and preserving existing affordable housing, but making sure it's in better condition, while at the same time building new housing that ensures that there's a mix of different housing alternatives in the neighborhood and that the neighborhood in the long run becomes a community of opportunity and a community of choice.
As for what constitutes affordable?
If you're a family of 4, incomes of $51,000 a year would qualify you to own a home in Mountain View. A lot of people don't think they qualify. And when you look at Anchorage, 50% of the population in Anchorage would qualify.
The North Bliss Street Cook Inlet Housing Authority townhouse units are currently scheduled for completion in the spring of 2010. This is Len Anderson.
One of Alaska's largest and most notorious fishing ports has gone smoke-free. Unalaska, also known as Dutch Harbor, now has a ban on smoking in all public buildings, including businesses, restaurants, and bars. KUCB's Ann Hillman went down to the Harbor View Bar to see how people were taking it.
It's Monday night karaoke at the largest bar in Unalaska. About 40 people wander in and out. Fishermen sit drinking at the bar, women get up to belt out karaoke songs, and others play foosball and pool. A typical night, except there's no smoke in the air. For the first time ever in Unalaska, people have to go outside of the bar to light up their cigarettes. Fisherman Nathan Reed stands with a group of his friends out back smoking.
Well, I have to come outside. It's not so bad right now, you know. Probably cold in the winter, but I don't really mind that much.
Others vehemently disagree. Carrie Arrington says she thinks the decision should not have been up to the city council.
If you're in the bar all night drinking, you're obviously not that much of a health nut that you're so worried about secondhand smoke. Honestly, I mean, you're drinking all night, you're trashing your liver, okay? So you get a little secondhand smoke, so what? I think it's just wrong for a governing body to tell private industry how to run it. That borders on socialism.
Jessica Culp agrees.
It's not a matter of if it's inconvenient for people to come out. When you've got five people that come to the bar twice a year on wine tasting night and fireman's ball, and they complain about people smoking, well, they have the choice. Now, I can understand banning it in restaurants, in the airport where there are children, but anybody that comes into a bar is 21 or older, and they have the choice of whether they want to subject themselves to the smoke or not.
Back inside the bar, longtime fisherman Philip Stromset sits with his friends. A smashed cigarette lies at his feet, snuffed out as soon as it was lit.
I smoke, but you know what? If the people that don't want smoke in a bar, they can go to the liquor store and go get drunk at home.
Bar manager Randy Batten says, as a smoker, even he instinctively lit up inside.
I was the first one in the bar to light one up in the bar without thinking about the man. My doorman had to throw me out first to go out and smoke outside. So I was the first one.
He says people are concerned about having to go outside and leave their drinks unattended. They worry that other people will take their drinks, do something to them, or they will be cleared away because the servers think they left the bar. He says patrons also worry about the winter.
During the wintertime, you know, people are going to have their trucks parked out front, even if they don't plan on driving them home at the end of the night. But people are saying when the snow's out and stuff, what if I jump in my truck to warm up, you know, and start my engine up to get my heater going and smoke a cigarette in my truck rather than outside? Am I going to get a DWI by the cops for jumping in my car and smoking a cigarette, even though I never had a plan to drive anywhere at the end of the night? I'm just trying to keep warm and not freeze to death outside in the smoking area.
The bar plans on building a deck out back and maybe an enclosed smoking shelter, but it wouldn't be completed until next summer. Batten says he thinks business at the bar will drop off some because people are fairly upset, but he's sure that it will bounce back.
You know, it just takes a little while to get used to the idea. You know, you still like to be around your friends. You still want to be around other people. You know, you can't drink at home forever.
The smoking ban was put before the city council by a group of residents last fall and was discussed in open public meetings over a six-month period. The council considered putting it on the ballot, but did not after listening to public comments on the issue. The ordinance passed 6-0. If a person is caught smoking inside a public building, they could be fined $100 for the first offense and more for subsequent offenses. In Unalaska, I'm Ann Hillman.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Shane Iverson in Hooper Bay, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Len Anderson in Anchorage, and Ann Hillman in Unalaska. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Gooseberry Peter. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, and by the Doyon family of companies working together to build Alaska's future.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.